Hello and welcome to Playback. On this week's programme, on his first day in the job, we hear from one of the country's new personal insolvency practitioners.
As a PIP, I would be making a very strong case, for example, that a solicitor should have a bigger house that accords with his professional status in society.
Author Colm Tobin talks about writing and shortlists.
The only thing you think about sometimes is the next sentence, and maybe the sentence after.
John Simpson on Syrian President Bashar al-Assad.
He's about the least likely dictator you can imagine.
Sean O'Rourke talks to Eamon Gilmore about Joan Burton.
She wants your job, it's as simple as that.
And Eamon Dunphy talks about Republic of Ireland soccer managers.
Given my track record of recommending managers, perhaps I should shut up.
But first, on Tuesday night, the shutters came crashing down on Ireland's chances of qualifying for the World Cup. During Wednesday's Morning Ireland Sports Bulletin, we heard some of the highs and lows of that game, suitably underscored by the Ultravox classic Vienna.
Fuchs is available behind him and he's played it out to his captain. Level with the edge of the penalty area, his left footed cross is low. Janko was across, Wilson there. Alaba trying to get the goal and he's got the goal. Alaba did the damage in Dublin with a late equaliser. And with his right foot, he buries the ball into the back of the net in the 84th minute. And that will keep their chances of going to the playoffs alive. But the Republic of Ireland, this will be the end of their chances of going to the World Cup. David Ford finally beat, a scrappy goal. And Alaba, the 21-year-old, is hit back to break Irish hearts again.
Difficult for us because we keep getting branded with the same, well, he's not good enough, he's a this and that, and then, but yet we're expected to qualify for every tournament. So, I mean, there has to be a point where we're honest with you and say, look, this is where we are at the moment. I think you see the effort from the lads today shows what we think of them. You know, we've been fortunate, we've had really good times and we've got close to the World Cup before and we got to the Euros, like I said, and obviously tonight is disappointing, but 100% the manager has been good to us all, so we all stand by him.
From Wednesday's Morning Ireland. Later on Wednesday morning, we heard the news that Giovanni Trapattoni was gone. On Drive Time, John Delaney of the FAI told Tony O'Donoghue how the decision came about.
It's been a difficult 4 or 5 days for Irish football. You can imagine, you know, when we lost at home to Sweden, it looked at all but our World Cup qualification chances had ended. Certainly the defeat last night confirmed that. So we spoke to the manager last night at the airport. We were flying home, as everybody knows. We arrived in around 3 or 4 in the morning. So I spoke to him in Vienna and said, listen, we should meet in the morning. And we met at 9:30 this morning. I have to say there was a lot of emotion in the room because you're working with a man and Marco Tardelli and Trapattoni and Tardelli and Foster Rossi for 5.5 years. And it was a very practical and friendly discussion that led to the decision today that Giovanni would leave the job as managing the Irish team.
How would you describe your relationship with Giovanni Trapattoni now? Do you think it's deteriorated or do you think it's the same?
No, Tony, it's not. There was a hell of a lot of emotion in that room this morning when you were saying goodbye, but not goodbye forever, because I'm sure at some stage in the future we'll meet up. He's a good man. He's a legend in the world game, as we all know. And you know, you have to recognise that in your dealings. I think there was a lot of dignity there this morning. I've been involved in, you know, managers leaving in the past, but in this particular one, there was a lot of emotion, a lot of friendship.
John Delaney is heard on Wednesday's Drive Time. Throughout the day on Wednesday, the implications of Trapattoni's exit were discussed by a number of commentators. Speaking on the news at 1, Niall Quinn gave Áine Lawler his assessment of the legacy of the outgoing manager.
I think it's a sad day, obviously, for Irish football. When the manager goes in these circumstances, it means morale is low, there's disillusionment in the air, and we scratch our heads and we try and make out of Giovanni what we can. For me, he inherited a team. He had at least five, what I would say, top players in Shay Given, Damien Duff, Robbie Keane, Richard Dunne, John O'Shea, all in the prime of their career. And I think that stood to him, and he was able to bring guys on alongside him. But did he really bring them on so that they could take over from that group in the future? I don't think so. And I'd worry about the new manager coming in more so than Giovanni's attempts. I think what he's left us with isn't great. He did his best, I'm sure. I mean, people say he wasn't interested and he didn't go to watch matches. He has a philosophy. He's old-fashioned. He comes from that ilk. He's not the guy to be watching videos 24 hours a day, travelling to see players. The modern game dictates that you must do that. And I think it caught him out a little bit. But, you know, one of the other reasons I think that stood against him, the communication between him and what the fans wanted to hear was just, it became almost annoying at times, that if he had made decisions, he didn't bring certain substitutions on, didn't play players. He never really told us why, and he attempted to do it in a broken Italian-English way, which none of us really got to understand. So there was a lot of things that I wouldn't have personally liked about him, but I do think he was a great football man with a great pedigree, and maybe he came to the Ireland team perhaps maybe 10 years too late in terms of what his capabilities were and his career.
Niall Quinn talking to Áine Lawler on Wednesday's News at 1. So who will be the next manager of the Republic of Ireland? On the Today Show, Sean O'Rourke ran some of the possible names in the hat by Eamon Dunphy. And one of those names was a manager who Eamon Dunphy has in the past been known to have a relationship which is probably best described as combative.
Mick McCarthy.
Yes, Mick has done really well. He took us to the World Cup in 2002. I still would say he should have managed the Saipan thing differently with Keane. But leaving that aside, he did great work at Wolves, keeping them in the Premier League. He's managing an Ipswich now. I think he has conducted himself with great dignity when he was badly treated by Wolves. His team's played good football. The only thing against him, Sean, would be that he's been there. But, you know, I don't think I'd be screaming the house down if he got the job again.
And he'd probably wait.
Yeah, give him a couple of games.
Yeah,
no, I'd respect McCarthy, Mick McCarthy, a lot more now than I did when he was actually a younger man.
Were you wrong the last time then?
Well, I think I underestimated him, yes. I think the problem that arose in Saipan was his responsibility ultimately. He was the manager. Going to that place with no football pitch and the way he handled the Roy Keane debacle was unfortunate. But you have to look at the man over the span of his coaching career. So on reflection now, don't forget 10, 12, 11 years have passed since Saipan, I'm prepared to say that he has proved himself to be a much better manager than I thought he was.
What about this new director of football, high performance director, Rude
yep.
Doctor? Maybe he should be put in charge of the recruitment.
Well, he'll have enough on his plate because there is a job to be done at grassroots level and with our younger players that's very, very important for the future of the game in this country. The international team manager's job is you need someone who has experience and the temperament not to be troubled by the pressures of it. It's Martin O'Neill, I hope. Although, given my track record of recommending managers, perhaps I should shut up.
From Wednesday's Today with Sean O'Rourke. This was also the week in which we became familiar with an abbreviation for a new profession in Ireland, that of the PIP, or the Personal Insolvency Practitioner. There are just 37 of them in the country, and on Monday's Drive Time, Mary Wilson spoke to one of those PIPs, Jim Stafford. When a listener to the show emailed in a question about what will happen to his home if he enters into a personal insolvency arrangement, Mr. Stafford gave this response.
Under the legislation, the PIP is to try and keep the family in their family home, if at all possible. The PIP will have to assess the existing mortgage on the family home, if it's a modest house, if it's a trophy house. In practice, the PIP will also have to assess the type of a house that we'll say that might be needed for a professional person, such as a solicitor, accountant, or a hospital consultant, as opposed to a house that's needed by someone who is in the PEYE sector, for example. Mm-hmm. So that, as a PIP, I would be making a very strong case, for example, that a solicitor should have a bigger house that accords with his professional status in society, so that his neighbours and clients can see that, yes, this person is a good solicitor, he's living in a good house, etc., etc.
Really?
Absolutely. And same for hospital
consultants. Despite the fact that he's insolvent?
despite the fact that he is insolvent. Because remember, if we want the solicitor to continue to earn money, or the accountant or the hospital consultant to earn money, it's important that he has his tools of trade. If you, for example,
well, he may need an office, but he hardly needs a palatial house in South County Dublin, for example.
Well, believe me, the clients that we have in our books are insisting that they continue to live in their palatial houses. Now, it's possible that some of them might have to down trade, but that's all put into the pot.
From Monday's Drive Time. On Tuesday's Live Line, Philip Boucher-Hayes fielded calls from Bernard and Jerry, who were both outraged at the distinction Mr. Stafford had drawn between professional and PAYE workers. When Mr. Stafford came on to defend his position, Philip put it to him that it sounded as if he would be willing to work harder to keep a professional person in his or her home.
I did not say that, OK? We work equally hard for all of our clients, providers that they have a proposal.
Are you taking PAYE workers on, Jim?
We do have PAYE workers on our books.
So you weren't making a pitch for the business of the asset rich of the professional classes?
No, absolutely not. I mean,
why would you insult PAYE workers then?
Philip, it's very difficult to talk about all of the complexities of probably was the most complex legislation passed in the history of the state in a 10-minute interview, where Mary Wilson had about 20 questions to ask me.
OK, my one question is, why would you seek to insult PAYE workers in the way that you very obviously have if you are seeking their business?
Philip, I didn't insult any worker.
OK, hang on a second. Bernard, were you insulted?
Of course I was. Absolutely. And so was I.
Jerry, were you insulted, Jan?
I was very, very insulted. I think Mr. Stafford is backtracking here big time. I think he made a terrible blunder and called it as it is. The system is set up to look after the professional classes. And I think he made a blunder by saying it yesterday, and it's coming home to roost now.
Jim?
Oh, I think, Philip, in fairness to myself, I might have been clumsy in my choice of words. The distinction I was making yesterday was the distinction between high-income earners and low-income earners. And it follows from that high-income earners might still be insolvent, but they still have income coming in, and that they can still afford a bigger mortgage than a low-income earner. And you can't deny that.
Yeah, but hang on a second. They can't afford the trophy home that they are in. Why should they not be made to downsize if that's what it comes to, just as much as the PAYE worker?
And Philip, some of our clients will be forced to downsize, and some of our clients will be forced to sell the properties. But the point I made to Mary Wilson yesterday, and the point that Evan seems to be missing, is that this all goes into the pot. All the clients that come to us, okay, many of them are highly stressed, but they all have the same desire and the same passion keep the family home, whether it's a low-income person or a high-income person. The passion, Philip, believe me, is absolutely
intense. Yeah, okay, but that's not what you said, Jim. What
home.
You said was that the professional person needed to maintain their status within the community, or their need was greater than that of the PAYE worker.
Philip, I didn't say their need was greater. What I said was that I passed on what clients have been saying to me, that this is why they perceive that they need to keep their houses because of their status and to maintain their standards. That's not my personal view, Philip.
Personal insolvency practitioner Jim Stafford talking to Philip Boucher-Hayes on Tuesday's Liveline. Seamus Sherlock is a man who came to international attention earlier this year when he staged a sit-in at his farm after the bank had served him with an eviction notice. On last Saturday's Marion Finucane show, he told Marion how he reacted when he received that letter.
I actually picked it up in the letterbox at the gate. I live in a long driveway.
Yeah.
So I just happened to go into town to get some supplies for the animals, and I just picked it up. And I just randomly opened the envelope, and I must say I got it hard to breathe for about 10 minutes. The first thing that went through my mind was my children. My God, my children. And I didn't even know how I was going to tell them. But as I say already, I started a group in 2010 called Life After Death. So my kids were actually used to people coming into the house, sitting at the table and telling us all their problems. So we just sat down and said, listen, guys, this is where we are now.
What age were they?
From 13 to 22.
So you sat down, you told them, and then...
We decided we wanted to try keep the place and try pay for it like we always did. We never turned our back on the bank or anyone else. So we barricaded the gate. We went out and we blocked the gate with silage bales. We put 40 silage bells against the gate, and I started to ring a few friends and neighbours. And within an hour or two, we had four or five people there. And basically, we had people there in 24 hours a day, every single day, standing at the gate.
From where?
From all over Ireland. They came from all over Ireland. When once word got out what we were doing, for the first few days it was just family and friends.
Yeah.
But after 2-3 days, people started to turn up with their tents, coming for a week, coming for 3 days. And then we had a very good friend who donated a log cabin, which meant the people that were coming to stay could actually have a decent roof over their heads. So that's what we done. We took a day at a time. We really didn't know where it was going to go.
When you got the eviction, did you ring your solicitor?
Oh, I did straight away, yeah.
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 And did you tell him or her, this is what I'm going to do?
Yeah. And they actually said, you have no real option. You have no real option. Or else you're going to lose your home. You're going to be homeless.
So what were you going to do if the sheriff had arrived alone?
That's a good question. Well, my safety of my children would be first. We were going to peacefully try to protest, as in no violence, but we were going to link arm in arm and not leave. They would have had to drag us off. The children decided that with me. They said, we're standing together, Dad. There's no way we're giving up. And I was very proud, actually, in a way, scared in most way, but very proud to see kids standing with their father like that. And you know, I even get emotional about it now.
Seamus Sherlock talking to Marion Finucane last Saturday. Labour Party leader and Taoiseach Eamon Gilmore was Sean O'Rourke's guest in the Today studio on Tuesday. It was a wide-ranging and robust interview, and at one point Sean asked the Taoiseach about his relationship with one of his cabinet colleagues.
Tell me about your relationship, your political relationship with John Burton. It seems to be a very difficult one.
It's not. I have a very good working relationship with John Burton. I have a very good political relationship, and I have a very good personal relationship with John Burton. And to be honest, I'm a bit bemused by some of the commentary that I read.
That's
about
exactly
this.
The kind of stuff that people like Tony Blair and Gordon Brown used to say about each other back in the 90s and the early noughties. And then when Andrew Rawnsley produced his book, the exact opposite turned out to be the case.
Well, I have a very good relationship with Joan Burton. She's doing an outstanding job. She has a difficult job to do. Ministry of Social Protection, particularly in these difficult times, is challenging. She's doing an excellent job.
You want to be a blind dog, as David Hanley used to say, not to notice that she wants her job and wants your job, and an awful lot of people would agree with that assessment.
But why shouldn't she? I would hope that every member of the parliamentary party wants my job.
No, Sean.
But again, I mean, this is
anybody who's want to be Taoiseach.
That's right. Anybody who's a TD for the Labour Party, I'm sure, has an aspiration to lead it.
Well, not that I want to be over-plugging Pat Leahy's book, but a couple of points in it, and he talked about it yesterday. I mean, the notion that Joan Burton would let it be known that she consigned the Gilmore for Taoiseach posters to her father's shed, that she was contemptuous about your line at the launch of your party manifesto about Frankfurt's way or Labour's way, and we know how that ended, and she thought it was a bad way to do business. I mean, clearly it's a strained relationship and remains so.
It's not. You know, we have a very good relationship. I was at the hurling match on Sunday with her. We talked about a number of issues and several things, which have nothing to do. Nothing to do with politics. We have a very good. No, I want to lay that to rest because again, it's one of these things that keeps cropping up, and it's not. Look, politics is always, there's always speculation about who's getting on with who, who's arguing with whom. There's a kind of a soap opera kind of dimension that kind of often goes around the edges of politics. It goes with the territory, Sean. It doesn't cost me a thought. It doesn't cost Joan a thought. We work very well together. We have a very good relationship, and that's where it stands.
Just one quote, and I won't repeat or go back into Leahy's book again, but he says, things have not improved, and since the spring of this year, Joan Burton has set out on a subtle strategy to become leader of the Labour Party. She delivered carefully worded statements to media, which delicately insinuated her unhappiness with the current economic strategy and austerity. She wants your job. It's as simple as that.
Well, I haven't read Pat Leahy's book. He didn't talk to me about the book when he was. When he was writing it.
Eamon Gilmore on Today with Sean O'Rourke on Tuesday. Another story of the week was the shortlisting for the third time of Irish author Colm Tobin for this year's Booker Prize. On Wednesday's Morning Ireland, on the line from Texas, the author told Fran McNulty about the process of turning The Testament of Mary from a stage play into a book.
Well, it was because it was a Sunday night in the Project Art Centre, and Marie Mullen had done her last performance, and I had really been riveted by her performances. And then I said, who are those guys coming up who went up the stairs just now? And someone said, oh, they're coming to dismantle the set. I suddenly realised it was all over. And I remember walking back home through Dublin thinking, well, that's all over. And then realising, actually, no, because I have every draft, every version, everything I thought of at home still. And I work in longhand, and I had all these notebooks. And I, therefore, as a sort of consolation to myself, I took them all out again. And I started again.
In doing so, did you ever envisage that it would become Man Booker long-listed and short-listed in turn, or were you simply just trying to put something more permanent on the shelf?
I think if you start thinking like that, I mean, I think if you ever, even in your wildest dreams, start to think, you know, this book I'm writing now is for that purpose, I think that you would lose something in the book, and I also think you would lose your own mind, you know, and you'd also go around like a complete fool, you know. In other words, that these things happen by accident. If you think about them, they don't happen. And if you don't think about them, they also sometimes don't happen. So you just cannot think about that those, you know, the only thing you think about sometimes is the next sentence. And maybe the sentence after, but just concentrate on that, and the other thing then is another matter.
This is the third time you found yourself in this Man Booker circle or circus, as some might call it. What does it mean to you, or is it possible it might mean more to your publishers? Because really, this is about selling books, and far more people will read the Testament of Mary now, will they not?
It means the same thing to the publishers and to me. They call it sales. And I call it readers. And you write for readers. In other words, I wasn't working for myself. This is a form of communication. And so getting more readers for me is very important. And getting more sales for the publishers is also important. So it makes a very big difference to both the publishers and to me in that sense.
Booker Prize shortlisted author Colm Tobin talking to Fran McNulty on Wednesday's Morning Ireland. With Flight Fest taking place in Dublin this weekend, there was a bit of an aviation theme going on in the Mooney studio all week. On Tuesday, former RAF navigator Dubliner David Henchy spoke to Derek about his life in the sky. Derek asked him if, as a navigator, he was ever envious of the pilot.
Absolutely not. You have to understand that navigators and air traffic controllers tell pilots where to go, whereas pilots just pull the airplane. Now it's changed. I have to take the tongue out of my cheek when I say this, but it's changed today. With all this, the navigators are redundant, sadly. Air traffic controllers are not. But there is so much good equipment in the airplane, and the pilots have to do so much more than just fly the airplane now. But in my day, they didn't do much navigation. They aided by telling the pilot what they saw or looked out, and it was a joint effort, as it were. But basically, they were there to fly the aeroplane, so we passed them, and I'm putting this in inverted commas, we passed them their bananas so that they were happy, and we did all the work. I mean, that was the standard joke. And the air traffic is the same. And I was very fortunate. I liked flying, and I was tolerably okay as a pilot, except that I couldn't land. So that was a bit...
You couldn't land?
Well, I had great difficulty putting the aeroplane safely on the ground. I could take it off and I could fly around the sky as happy as Larry. But I used to tense up, and it was stress, and you get a bit nervous, and I wasn't that good at it. So the Air Force said, no, please, we don't want you to break any aeroplanes, so go and be a navigator.
Derek also asked David about the working conditions inside his aircraft.
They flew, designed to fly low level, with big transparent nose and side windows. So a lot of the time when you were flying, you lay in the nose with your map in front of you and you're
looking at it.
And just navigated it on map reading. You didn't have an ejection seat, which I found a bit disconcerting because the pilot did. but you actually sat, when you were doing high level, you sat at a little table virtually at the pilot's feet. It was a big bubble canopy, nice nose, and then a fighter-type canopy. Pilot was up there, and just about where his feet came, there was a table sideways on to the side of the aircraft, and you sat there and you had your instruments and your radar fixing aids and etc. all around you. And then if you wanted to go map reading, you got out and lay in the nose. The beauty of it, when we were going down to Cyprus, down the Mediterranean, you headed south from Germany till you hit the French coast, somewhere around Marseille. And then really you could do the rest from just looking out the window. You said, this is the heading you need. You head down towards Sicily. As soon as you get to Sicily and you see less, you keep a bit to the... So keep Sicily on your left, and then you turn left over Malta and then straight down the middle of the Mediterranean, past Crete to Cyprus. And if you got a bit too far to the left one way, you could see the coast and the European coast in Turkey. Or if you got a bit too far the other way, you could see North Africa. So you just sat in the middle of the Mediterranean at 45,000 feet and looked out the window.
You must be fantastic at geography.
Oh, quite good.
Yep.
From Tuesday's Mooney, the conflict in Syria continued to dominate the airwaves throughout the week. BBC World Affairs editor John Simpson was Sean O'Rourke's guest in studio on Tuesday. In the course of the interview, he gave a personal profile of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad.
He's about the least likely dictator you can imagine. In fact, he's not a dictator. It's quite interesting, really, to me. I spent a day in his company now some years ago, I think 2006 or something, and I did a long interview with him. The interest at that time was, how is he going to turn Syria into some form of democracy? Because it did seem as though that was his intention, when he certainly said it was. He was an ophthalmologist from London, from North London, an eye doctor, in other words, eye surgeon. And his wife, a very attractive British woman of Syrian parentage, a very classy couple. They seemed as though they were going to really change things. But the fact is, he wasn't then and isn't now in real charge. He just happened to be the eldest surviving son of a nasty dynasty, and they shouldn't have put him in the job. He should still be inspecting people's eyes and doing cornea operations and stuff. He's not suited to the job.
Did he have ambitions to be a moderniser of some sort? And if so, where did it all go wrong?
I don't know whether ambitions is the word. I think he had hopes. I think he thought that since he was the president, he really could make these things happen. What he didn't, I think, count on was that his brother is a very nasty character indeed, but he's the younger brother, and there was also a very nasty uncle, much more in the mould of the father, old Assad, President Assad, who seized power and stayed in power for 30 years in the most brutal way. And most of the family are like that. Poor old Bashar is the least like that, but because he's the eldest surviving son, he's got the job. It's a mess. And obviously, in Syria itself, although he's got supporters and followers, you know, they're not going to win this.
John Simpson, as heard on Tuesday's Today with Sean O'Rourke. Another conflict zone featured heavily in this week's Book on One. Blood, Sweat and Tears, an Irish soldier's story of love and loss, provided a vivid account of Tom Clonan's time spent in Lebanon in the mid-1990s. In this extract, he recalls an episode in October 1995 when Israel retaliated to a dawn attack by Hezbollah.
The shelling rages around us for over an hour. Every few minutes, A Company troops fire red flares into the early morning light. This is by way of a formal arrangement between the Israelis and the Irish. The flares are a mutually agreed warning signal indicating that direct hostile fire, intentional or otherwise, is impacting on our UN positions. The clattering of gunfire intensifies each time we send up a flare. At 12 p.m, we move up the track. At the junction of the track and the ditch, I dismount with Sergeant Begley. We escort the medics up towards the two bodies. Both are intact. Both have been stripped of weapons and other equipment by the Israelis. The medics work in complete silence. I'm amazed at how gentle they are. They work as a team to heft the bodies into two body bags. As the zippers buzz shut, the relief is palpable. We scour around for personal effects. The bodies are stretchered back to the Sisu. When we get back down to Hedata, the bodies are handed over. The women are screaming. The sergeant mutters, "Jesus, Mary and Joseph." We drive in silence all the way back to Aliaton. I'm sitting in the footwell of the Sisu, writing a report as we head in. Corporal Kennedy is drinking coffee. His hands, calloused with hate and love tattooed on his knuckles, are shaking.
Tom Clonan, reading from his book, Blood, Sweat and Tears, An Irish Soldier's Story of Love and Loss, as heard on Monday's Book on One. Colm Keane was Miriam O'Callaghan's guest in studio on Monday, where he spoke about his new book, Padre Pio, The Scent of Roses, which includes 60 testimonials of people who attribute cures and miracles they have experienced to Padre Pio. Colm told Miriam about how he himself experienced the scent of roses associated with Padre Pio.
I had a son who had cancer. He died of cancer about 6 years ago and was a huge loss to myself and my wife. But I can remember on one occasion, my son was in the bedroom across from me. My wife was sleeping on the floor looking after him, and I was in bed on my own. 4 o'clock in the morning, I woke up with a sudden start, and I was overwhelmed by this smell. My mum used to grow roses when I was young, and we lived near the sea, and I'd come home from tennis and she'd be watering the roses, and there would be this enormous smell of roses, like that to the power of about 20 or 30. And it was around 4 o'clock in the morning, and I felt a huge presence. I was writing my first book on Padre Pio at the time. I was praying to Padre Pio at the time for a cure for my son. And I sat there and I sat up in the bed. I thought this is just some hallucination. But it wasn't. It stayed there for about 4 or 5 minutes and eventually disappeared. And it was a very moving experience for me. They say it is that Padre Pio is with you. He's accompanying you. He's there.
That's an incredible story for you to just tell like that. But could it possibly be your mind playing on you? In other words, Colm, at that moment, you were, as you say, researching Padre Pio. Your beloved son is dying. You're looking for a miracle.
Yeah.
Could that, people might think, just be your mind playing on you? So you wake up and you imagine you smell roses.
Well, I'm a big skeptic when it comes to all the books that I write. There is no doubt about that. And you could talk about auto-suggestion and the power of mind over matter. But the first thing I would do is eliminate things. I don't wear aftershave. I never have. My wife never wears perfume. So there would have been none of it in the house. So you could eliminate that.
But it's interesting, Colm, you were talking there about your son, Sean. And he was your only child.
He was, yeah.
Which is so cruel. But Padre Pio, if he is so great at miracles and you have this devotion, how do you then explain to yourself he didn't save your son?
Yeah, I've no idea. And I really don't. And the one thing that I'm sure of, having spoken to so many people, is that it's not a function of your goodness or the goodness of the person or the power of the prayer or the amount of prayer or the amount of devotion that you have. I'm sure of that. I've spoken to people who had no devotion and a relic is brought in and there's this extraordinary transformation, instantaneous almost, where they start getting well. So there's no connection there. Miriam, I've written books on near-death experiences and deathbed visions and all of that. And I'm coming around to the idea that maybe there is some destiny for us, maybe that there is a time. You know, people are told after a near-death experience where they meet deceased relatives, it's not your time, go back. Maybe we all have a time. I'm not sure of that. My son, you've asked me about him there briefly. Yeah. He worked very hard, won medals at everything, top of his year, top of his class, crammed so much into his life. And I always think that he was a bright, shining star. Maybe he outlived his time. He had done everything and moved on.
Colm Keane talking to Miriam O'Callaghan on Monday. Rory Kennedy, the youngest of Bobby Kennedy's 11 children, was in studio with Sean O'Rourke on Wednesday. She's currently in Ireland for the screening of Ethel, the new documentary film she has made about her mother. She spoke to Sean about the impact that the death of her Uncle Jack had on her father.
It was such an intense, overwhelming experience for my father. And I think that, you know, not only had he lost his best friend, his brother, in such a violent way, but he also, you know, his job, everything that he had built was connected and interconnected to my Uncle Jack in such an intimate way. So I think that he was really lost. But I think, as my sister Kathleen very insightfully says, he took that as an opportunity to really explore a lot of his own emotional pain and I think he emerged from it with an extraordinary sense of compassion and understanding, and he really used that experience to understand other people's pain and other people's agony, and ultimately made the decision to run for president himself in 1968, in part because I think he saw what was going on with the civil rights movement, he saw what was going on with Vietnam, and he really felt like he could make a difference and in the lives of people who were struggling so much and really felt this country was going in the wrong direction. And so it really stems from that experience and that loss that I think he found it in himself to run.
What was quite striking as well was watching your mother, clearly a reluctant participant, but feeling she had a duty, I suspected, to take part in this program. She found there was a certain flow to her conversation with you in the early days, even talking as well about JFK's assassination, talking as well about how your dad came about to deciding to run for the presidency, but she just did not want to talk about the assassination.
Well, you know, she's of a certain generation, and I would imagine folks here in Ireland can understand that as well, where they just don't talk about difficult moments in such a comfortable way, and really don't want to, I think, feel sorry for herself or explore those issues emotionally that. And so, yes, she was very reluctant to talk about a number of issues. But I think in the way she responds to those questions, it speaks volumes of how she processed her own losses.
Rory Kennedy talking to Sean O'Rourke on Wednesday. Brenda Fricker was one of Miriam O'Callaghan's guests on Wednesday. She also spoke about her relationship with her mother, although hers was a particularly harrowing story.
She's been dead, 33 years. And it was only 2 years ago that I put up a gravestone. She was in an unmarked grave for all those years because I just couldn't face it, and my sister couldn't face it. And we'd had a long talk. Luckily, I went down to see my sister the week before she died, and we said, look, if you die before me, we have to get a thing, and we made that agreement. Then she went and died on me, so I was left with a bloody job to do. And it took me like a year to get the courage to go out and face the grave and, you know, get the tombstone. I didn't want to lie on the tombstone. I didn't want to say beloved mother. And so I worded it very carefully, and it's done. So that was a bit of peace.
What are the words?
I just put, she left behind Grania Brenda, and put my her grandchildren's names on it, and then to put she was loved by many. So I didn't involve myself at all, really.
Did you love her?
I think I'm beginning to now. I think I'm getting therapy for it. And I think we're breaking through that. I'm beginning to forgive her and to understand her. And I think I'll get there, yeah.
Do you mind briefly telling people what she was like to you?
I remember talking to somebody my own age, and when I said she used to beat us, and she said, oh, for God's sake, stop looking for attention. We all got beaten in those days, you know. But this wasn't just a slapper on the head or anything. I mean, she used to pick branches from the trees and peel off the outer skin until you had the bare thing inside. And she would beat the backside off you, and she'd kick you with the hoover. She was a violin player, and she'd be practising her Irish dancing. She'd whack you with the violin bow. I mean, we're always bleeding. And she'd always do it below your knees, so my father wouldn't see it. And she'd put knee socks on, and she'd cover it all up. And I was petrified of her. I mean, every time she moved, it was to hit you, you know. It was extremely violent. And I mean, Colette Dunn lived across the road, and her sister Miriam wrote a book about Annaville Park. And she describes us walking. She remembered seeing my mother beating us with broken orange box bits and us bleeding, and that the neighbours were worried, should they, because there was no child protection society or anything then, and they were worried, should they go to the police? And so people knew that it was above and wrong, you know, it was above the average thing. It was dreadful, yeah, it was dreadful, yeah.
Brenda Fricker in conversation with Miriam O'Callaghan on Wednesday. The Dublin Fringe Festival is in full flight at the moment. On Thursday's Arena, Evelyn O'Rourke dropped in on rehearsals for a GAA musical of sorts produced by a Belgian theatre company, which also includes real-life Dublin fans.
We'll be there. There are some new people as well today, like Martin, Megan. Let's start with the haka.
Martin, why are you here?
I was just invited to come as a Dublin supporter, and I didn't know what I was coming to. I didn't think I'd be doing or trying to do the haka and singing and pretending we're singing it on Hill 16. So, yeah. Someone threw my name in the hat and I came like a fool wearing all my Dublin gear, and I come to all these multi actors of all ages and all half my age, probably old enough to be their daddy.
Are you glad you came?
Ah, yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, I've done a little bit of sort of acting before, and but maybe it might be a new career.
While the show may sound like a lot of fun, the creative team behind the production are deadly serious about their work.
Hi, my name is Gilles Descrever. I'm 28 years old and I'm a theatre maker from the company Het Kip, which Dublin Fringe has asked to make this production.
Originally devised in Belgium by the company Het Kip, the show now travels internationally, with the company creating localised adaptations like this one in Dublin.
The production was first staged like 2 years ago. We started off in Ghent, and it's a really community-based place, so we asked 50 of our closest friends and family members to make a theatre show in 10 or 11 days about mass emotion watching a sports game. In this particular case, it's the GAA. In Belgium, it was football, soccer.
There's an emotional moment where we sort of think we're losing, and we comfort ourselves with a song. But we don't sing it. We don't sing it in a very comforting way. Do you know the song Truly, Madly, Deeply? It's a love song by a boys band, but we do the kind of hooligan version. Are you guys okay to start singing right away? Do you need a moment? Catch your breath.
Hope I'll be your love, be everything that you need. I love you more with every breath, truly, madly, deeply do. I will be strong, I will be faithful, 'cause I'm counting on a new beginning, a reason for living.
Evelyn O'Rourke's report as heard on Thursday's Arena. Back in 1992, producer Ronan Kelly clipped a small microphone onto his four-year-old nephew's jumper as he attended his first day at school at Scoil Carmel in Firhouse in Dublin. The result was the documentary First Days, Final Days, the latter half of the title referring to the headmaster John Caulfield, who was just about to retire. Last week for the documentary on One, we heard First Days, Final Days Revisited, in which Ronan spoke to his nephew Ulton, who now lives in Australia, Mr. Caulfield, and schoolteacher Mary Brennan. This excerpt features the most miserable boy in the classroom that day, Patrick, as he was then and now.
You don't keep it up the longer I stay. Patrick. Here. Listen, I can see that scene now. I remember it, yeah. Just inside the door, and she was going, and I was holding him.
Coming back in a little while, Patrick.
Oh, there we go.
No, darling, you can't go out. Mummy's coming back in a little while.
There's my name.
Play with something, Patrick. Patrick. Mummy and Sarah will be back in a little while.
I'm just trying to escape out the door.
No, darling, no. Watch your fingers. Patrick, I don't believe it.
Yeah, I don't know, for some reason the door and the ceiling, I can remember them, like...
The young can't buy a good book.
Yeah, he is.
There's Mr. Caulfield saying I'm poor little fella.
I remember when you were born, Patrick. The lovely shorts and runners.
Go for a little walk around the pool to
Patrick. I do remember he was very upset. And they moved shortly after that to live in Waterford, so I never...
That wasn't nothing to do with you.
No, I think that was on the cards. The moving house was on the cards before Patrick came to Scoil Carmel.
I was only actually in the class for a year. So yeah, and then we moved to Waterford and lived down here ever since. So
Patrick is now 25 years of age with a big mop of curly hair. He's wearing a fleece and a pair of shorts and he's on the beach in Dunmore East in Waterford.
So we're going to get you into your kayaks now and show you how to use the paddles and all the gear. And we're going to head out and go explore some caves and rocks and all the coastline.
Patrick moved to Waterford because his dad's work brought them there. But Patrick has stayed in Waterford because of his dad's hobby, kayaking.
We're sitting on the beach in Dunmarese. There was the QE2 come in. It's one of my first memories of it. And I'm sitting on my dad's lap and we're out paddling around the QE2 like a massive cruise ship, you know. I was only maybe 8 or something like that back then. Since I was a little kid, started kayaking. And then when I was about 16 or 17, started instructing and working, and then eventually just started our own little business.
From Ronan Kelly's documentary on One, First Days, Final Days Revisited. That's about my lot for this week. To play us out, here's John Spillane, who is in studio with Miriam O'Callaghan on Friday. This is Hey Dreamer. I'm back again next week. So until then, goodbye.
Forgot who you are, you forgot what you are, you forgot what you're for, you've forgotten, you forgot where you're from, you forgot where you're going, you forgot everything, you've forgotten. Hey, dreamer, where did you leave your dream? Where did you leave your dream? Hey, dreamer, where do you hide your dream? Where do you hide your dream? Da-da-dam, da-da-da-dam, da-da-da-dam, da-da-da-dam. You are a star in the night. You are a wave shining bright. You are a bird in full flight. You've forgotten. You are a child on the run. You are a ray of the sun. You are everyone. You've forgotten. Hey, dreamer, where did you leave your dream? Where did you leave your dream? Hey, dreamer, where do you hide your dream? Where do you hide your dream? Da-da-dam, da-da-da-dam, da-da-da-dam, da-da-da-dam. You are a flame in the wind. You are a leaf in the breeze. You are a song in the trees. You've forgotten. You are a star in the night. You are a wave shining bright. You are a bird in full flight. You've forgotten. Hey, dreamer, where did you leave your dream? Where did you leave your dream? Hey, dreamer, where do you hide your dream? Where do you hide your dream?